Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea, Ryan Gibson here. Another episode of Financial Education. When it comes to trust and asset protection, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Wanted to thank everybody who came out. We had some United pilots, some American pilots, some Delta pilots flying into Houston for the bus tour, and we ripped. We had a great couple of dinners, and we took everybody around, filled up the bus, and had an awesome time. So thanks for coming. And
thanks for everyone that came to our inaugural investor weekend in Canyon City. It was an absolute blast. We had about 35 people come down to the St. Cloud Hotel. We did an amazing happy hour, dinner, speakeasy. It was a big night.
And you guys got the golf, which was way cooler than me. So
yeah, we got to golf our own course, the 4 Mile Ranch golf course, which is beautiful.
Amazing. This is like the thing that made me inspired to do this whole thing from the first place. Like, you're golfing on a golf course that you own. Like, this is the coolest thing ever.
And we had a number of investors that invested in that deal. And they're like, this is my course. How cool is this?
How cool is this, right? Like, I know self-storage is not the most exciting thing to go, but at least, you know, you can drive by it. You can touch it. You can feel it. It's a hard asset. You can understand it.
Absolutely.
And so that's what's fun about this investing. I think take all the emotions out of investing, but sometimes investing can be an emotional journey because you're putting your hard-earned money to work. And so I think it's really fun that Tate and I sort of do these things to bring you to the things that you invested in. Like, the investors all got to walk our self-storage properties.
Yep.
Now, it's not as fun as playing a round of golf, but you still got to walk the property and learn about it. So super fun.
And yeah, just to your point, during my welcome speech, I mentioned that we thanked everybody for coming out and really gave kudos to a group of individuals who are taking control of their financial future and choosing to invest their money on Main Street instead of Wall Street and changing the fabric of a community in Southern Colorado and actually getting to play their course and generating return in the meantime. And instead of saying, hey, I'm going to give another $100,000 to Wall Street, I'm going to put it into a real tangible asset that's going to make a difference in a community, going to make a difference in people's lives and generate a great return and some tax benefits and everything along the way. So anyway, it was a blast. Thank you for everyone that came out.
Yeah. Well, today we're talking about kind of some of the mitigating the downside risks of your investment. You know, how are you going to set yourself up and protect yourself against creditors and other people who are coming after you, right? The world is littered with billboards that say, I'm going, you know, call me if you want to sue somebody, right? I don't think you can drive more than half a mile in Vegas without seeing one of those signs. And that's just the reality is, like, unfortunately, the world we live in is one where people want to come after what you have. And so we want to bring on people that can talk about how to best position yourself to mitigate those things. And you're never going to be able to completely mitigate every little thing out of it. But we want to talk and interview someone who's an expert in this field and really help you out as you're thinking about acquiring more assets. As your wealth gets bigger, right? You're making more money, more green slips, more money in the bank, 401ks filled up, you know, college funds, real estate assets, syndications. These are all things that you're putting in your portfolio and you're starting to become wealthy. And so how do you protect that nest egg? And this is stuff that you probably don't talk about with the guy at your bank branch or the insurance person who's just selling you your car insurance. This is a much grander top level item that you have to start thinking about. You have to start thinking about your whole picture and how you're tying all this together and protecting yourself.
Absolutely.
And so I'm really excited. Tate, who's our guest today?
We have Adam Kinte back on the show. He came on in episode 119. That really was part one. Go back, listen to that if you haven't already. You could even go back and do a refresher. I've listened to it twice. It's a great episode. Builds the foundation for what we're going to talk about today. We're going to be talking about using partnership to clean up your tax return, insurance, all sorts of fun stuff. I promise it's fun. Let's get to the show.
Let's get into it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Adam Kinte, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Last episode was absolutely incredible. Before we get started, I really want to take everyone's attention and turn it back to episode 119. We talked about this in the intro, but seriously, if you haven't listened to 119, it's the starting point. This is part two of asset protection, LLC structure, all that stuff. So go back, listen to 119. Once you're done with that one, come here because we're picking up where we left off. So Adam, nice to have you back.
You know, Adam, I really want to start with why all this matters, right? Like who are we talking about? Who needs all these things? I do want to kind of frame the podcast. I know in 119, we went deep into entity structuring, basics of an LLC. What is asset protection, lawsuits, charging order protection, Nevada versus Wyoming, all these things. But can we kind of just set the stage with just why does a pilot care? Why does a professional care that's investing in these things? What's the high level? So what?
Yeah, the high level is that accidents happen. And we live in a world that it has gotten so far away from suing someone that's done something wrong to just trying to tie in the deep pockets. And that is the end game, is to make sure that any accident happens, that you are protected.
Now, I've been in business for a while and have bought a bunch of real estate. So naturally, when I have 43,000 customers, you know, I'm going to have issues, right? And so I've greatly benefited from these structures personally. And I'm just wondering, you know, could you kind of talk to the audience a little bit about, you know, so you put all this stuff in place, but you still can get sued. Can you kind of just walk through that and maybe tie it back to how this stuff will actually protect you maybe once you're in that lawsuit, but, you know, where it protects you, how it protects you?
Yeah. So I was just on the phone not 1 hour ago with a guy who has a franchise business that has several service vehicles. And one of his drivers was making a left-hand turn. A guy on an e-bike flies right underneath the back left tire of this van. He thought some stuff shifted around the back, and the driver didn't even know that he had ran a guy's head over, and the guy died. And he proceeds to drive home and parks the van, and a few hours later, the police show up. So now it's a criminal charge for hit and run. That's the start. And then we've got civil litigation, I'm sure, will be coming. But when these type of things happen, you want to get inside the mind of the judgment creditor's attorney. And what the attorney is looking for, and what they're looking for, is a payday. You see, Morgan & Morgan, with over 1,000 attorneys in every state, if we don't win, you don't pay a dime. They're all over the place. You know, go turn on the morning news or drive down the freeway, and good luck going for any amount of time without seeing a commercial or an advertisement.
There's a really good one. I actually like following him on Instagram. Sorry, I know we're on a side there, but there's a great guy, and he like raps to his team. I don't know if you've seen it. I can't remember the name of the Instagram handle, but it's like Your Family Attorney or something like that. It's really funny, by the way. Just as an aside, I'll put the link. No, I'm not putting the link in the show notes on that.
So, but
these attorneys are everywhere.
They're everywhere.
They're waiting for you to mess up, and you know, 1-800-CALL-SAM, and all these things, right? They're waiting for you to sort of like any little thing to come out of the sky. So keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. So the most important thing is that you, as a business owner or investor, we want to put these attorneys in a position that the best they can do is go after your insurance and see what they can get. You know, that is ultimately what you're looking for as an investor. And all the time I hear people say, well, I've got an umbrella policy. And they think that this umbrella policy is the end all be all to protecting their stuff. And not the case. So yeah, I'm not an attorney. I'm not a CPA. We have attorneys and CPAs in the office that do that work. But I was a licensed insurance agent in 43 states, and it's a dirty business. So the insurance companies have adjusters and attorneys whose job it is to pay out as little as possible on claims. And you can't blame them. If they paid out every claim that came through, they would quickly go bankrupt. So they, you buy insurance as a hedge against loss. So you're paying out a little bit. So if something bad happens, they cover it. Well, the insurance companies, they have their adjusters and attorneys whose job is to pay out a little bit. So you are competing with your insurance company to pay the least amount as possible. And who do you think is going to win every time? It will be them. So I hope that the insurance covers it. But if it doesn't, or if it doesn't cover enough, that's where the LLCs come into play in making sure that you are protected. So our goal is an attorney, they do an asset search. And it used to be to do an asset search, it took a lot of time and a lot of money. We'd have to hire private investigators and go dig through county records and try and figure out what you have. Well, now we have Google. And if I have your name and social security number, within 3 to 5 days' time, I will know everything about you. And if we don't have your social for a couple $100, they'll get it. There's all these tools that can find everything. So we got to make sure that we've got the entity structure in place before any accident happens. We've got these entity structures in place, trust set up properly, so that when the accident happens, the attorney does their research and they go back to their client saying, hey, these people are really smart. They've got these trust and LLCs. Our best option is go after the insurance and see what we can get.
So I want to dig into the anonymity thing because there are, you know, not to say that it's right or wrong. There are other groups that use a lot of anonymity to as a defense strategy. Say, you know, hide your assets, you know, make sure that nobody can find out what you own. What's your pushback to that? And how do you either agree or disagree with that with the technology that's out there to find out what you own, even if you've hid it?
Yeah, in my view, there is no such thing as privacy. If I want to find out something, we will find it out. So that's just the bottom line. So there's some firms that say, well, if they can't find you, they can't sue you. Oh, yes, they can. And they will find you and they will sue you. So I do my best to keep your ownership private on things so that in their preliminary search, they find nothing. That's our best bet. But this is why we use Nevada and Wyoming entities to manage your stuff, is because under Nevada and Wyoming law, the law says, under Wyoming, for example, you shall be indemnified. Acting as manager, member, managing member, agent, or employee of the LLC, you cannot be held personally liable for any lawful acts of the company. So as long as you're not committing fraud, you're protected. So when I formed the company, I always put your name on record as the manager. The membership or the ownership we would assign to you or to your revocable living trust, your family trust for estate planning purpose, but that's not on public record anyway. So it's important. This past weekend, I was doing an event in Denver, and I had several clients that I had helped out in the past, and we got their stuff set up, and I was just reviewing their documents to make sure everything's right. They have several rental properties, and I noticed the very first thing was in the agreement with their property manager. They said, well, Adam, these checks are coming to my name. I got my structure done, but the checks are coming to my name. So we pull up their paperwork, and yeah, sure enough, they didn't fill it out right. So the entity was not being used properly. And the W-9, which you have to fill out with a property manager, the W-9 was wrong. So yeah, they're still getting the checks. That is not right. So it's important not just to set it up, but also to operate it properly. And so those are things that I'm really big on when we're getting things set up, is making sure that your entity is going into business. Your entity is the one that's doing these things, and you're just signing contracts and agreements as manager.
Just to make sure that we're bringing everybody along here, you just said a lot. We talked about lawsuits. We talked about protecting your and hiding your assets. At what point in my career, if I'm a pilot, I don't do anything other than fly an airplane, at what point do I start to care about this? My first rental or without any real estate? When do I say this is applicable to me, all the things that we just have discussed so far?
Yeah, rental number one. So remember this, you've got not only your, you know, you might rent an apartment and you've got one rental property that may or may not have equity. You might have put 20% down, you just bought it, very little equity there, but you have future wages. And that is where we are. The missing piece that no one talks about is, yeah, they don't find your stuff, but you know, they can do some quick Google and Facebook or wherever and find out you're a pilot, and pilots make good money. And here we go.
And let's jump back to the insurance. You're saying that you're trying to, in that case of the guy going under the wheel of the van, and you're trying to get them out of coming after you and going after your insurance. Can we kind of pull on that thread a little bit? So what happens? So they go to the insurance company and the insurance company decides they're going to settle, let's say. What happens to my insurance then? Like what impacts down the road do I have when that happens?
Yeah. So this is you could have increases in premiums, of course, or they might drop you. And you got to go find another insurance provider. So look at all these poor people in California and other states where you can't find an insurance provider. They don't want to take the liability. So, but that's what happens. You file a claim, your premiums are going to go up, and they could even drop you as well.
Yeah. And how often do you see sort of the insurance company really lean in and litigate in situations like that? Versus just saying, hey, we're going to settle and not spend the money on litigation.
One of my clients is an attorney that this is what she does. And her name is Shay. And I said, Shay, she's been an attorney for 25 years and she is a trial attorney. And I said, how many times have you actually gone to trial? She said, Adam, I can count on one hand the number of times that we've actually gone to trial. Because we don't know what's going to happen. But we do know, statistically, more than 50% of the time, the plaintiff wins. So if you're the defendant, you're already on, statistically, on the short side of the stick. So she said, we don't know what the courts are going to do. I don't know what a jury is going to do. We don't know if they're going to believe the person lying or the person telling the truth. We don't know. So we try and settle at all cost. So that's their number one goal, is to settle the case.
And you have, you know, how much control do you have as the operator of the business over that outcome? When it gets kicked over to the insurance, are you completely out of it and it's up to them what they want to do? Or do you have any influence in that?
Yeah, the insurance company has a duty to defend you, but they also have a duty to the insurance company. So how much control you have? Little or none. So the guy I was just talking to today, he's got a deposition. The insurance company tells him, well, everything's going to be fine. We'll settle the case and we'll be good to go. And then they said, you've got a deposition coming up at the end of the month. Okay, well, why do you have a deposition? If everything's supposed to be fine, why do we have a deposition? And my guess is that the people that are suing are trying to find a chink in his armor, a little hole where they could say, okay, let's look at this driver. Was there any reason that did he have past DUIs, or has ever been drunk at work, or the service records of the vehicle maintained? Who knows what they're going to try and come up with, but they're looking for those chinks in the armor to try and come after him personally or come after the additional business assets.
Now, so that's the best case scenario. You've got this structure and it deflects the person to the insurance, right? And then maybe the insurance has a good outcome. You know, maybe they settle, but maybe your rates don't go up, you don't get dropped. It sounds like that's the best case scenario. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Now, let's say you don't have all this stuff set up. So what's the best case scenario in that? And what's the worst case scenario in that? You know, you don't have this legal structure, you don't have all these things to deflect to insurance. What's happening now as a pilot, in a pilot's perspective? Yeah.
Any assets you have, people aren't going to sue you to try and take your car. They're looking at the home you have or investment properties you have or your future wages. So that's what you're really working hard to defend, is that stuff that you have, right?
Yeah, that's a big deal.
I want to take a little tangent on the insurance, because if you have this stuff structured properly, which we talked about a lot in the last episode, setting up Nevada and Wyoming entities that have charging order protection, very hard to pierce the corporate veil. So you have entities that are structured correctly, and an attorney goes, hey, the best we can do is go after this guy's insurance or gal's insurance. What sort of insurance should the average person have? They have, you know, they're an airline pilot, they've got a few rental properties, there's some syndication deals, and we'll talk about how to structure that later. What sort of insurance should that person be carrying, and how do they find the best policies possible?
Yeah. So you have your homeowner's policy, you have your rental property policies, you have your, everybody should have an umbrella policy. So I was just talking about the fact that the umbrella, you can get a $1 million umbrella for $200-$300 a year. It's cheap for a reason. It only kicks in if the underlying policy exhausts policy limits. And I think your chances of winning the Texas state lottery are twice as good. But I have one for a reason. And the only insurance, in my view, the only insurance I have that might max out a policy limit is my auto insurance. And if kid gets in a car wreck, okay, cool. I've got the umbrella as my backup. Is it going to work? Probably not. but it's there. So those are the things that everybody should have, is you're insuring the properties that you have, and you're insuring the umbrella on top of it, just to make sure that we've done the best we could do.
I think it's also really important when we talk about homeowner policies. You know, there's a big difference between a homeowner policy and a rental property policy, an Airbnb policy, because there's times I've heard of cases where somebody owns a short-term rental, the guest burns it down, and they go to make a claim and they say, well, this didn't cover short-term rentals. So make sure that your insurance policy matches what you're doing. If you are, you know, we have a vehicle that my wife and I share, but she uses it for her business, for her S Corp. We pay a higher insurance rate because she's conducting business in the vehicle. You know, so you want to make sure that your policies align with the activity that you are conducting with those assets, right? Would you agree with that?
100%. So a lot of people, you know, your primary, you move to a new place, you turn it into a rental property. The very first call you need to make is to your insurance company and say, hey, I turned this into a rental. Or if you were, you know, you bought a house that needs to be fixed up a little bit before you rent it out, you got to let your insurance guy know, because if there was some major work that needs to be done, you bought it, you're in the process of fixing it up, and you get everything completed, put on the market, and there's vandalism or a flood or whatever. Well, because you didn't tell your insurance agent, it should have become a vacant dwelling policy. You get all the work done, now it becomes a vacant dwelling policy until someone moves in. But because you didn't tell your insurance guy that, that leaves them an opening to come back and deny claims.
What, in your opinion, you used to be an insurance broker in 43 states. What is the best way for someone to find an advocate, someone in their corner for insurance? Because insurance can be very difficult. Properties in Florida, very difficult now to insure. Properties in California can be very difficult to insure. Places that are fire prone. How does the average person go out and find a good insurance agent that can help them navigate all these different policies?
Yeah, I am no expert in that. I wasn't a broker, and I was an agent, that was 20 years ago. And the thing, you know, landscape has changed. So I'm the wrong guy to tell how to find a good insurance company, aside from, as with everything else, get 3 quotes and make sure that you check reviews. And just because something is cheap does not mean it is good. So they have AM Best is an insurance rating service. We want to make sure we find a good company that has good ratings, because there are times where you get a cheap policy and you file a claim, and yeah, good luck trying to get a check from these people. So that's important. I use Geico for my stuff, and then they have affiliates in, you know, they might have a subsidiary that provides insurance in a certain area. But that's the best move, is to call 3 companies, check the reviews, make sure you're dealing with a good company that's reputable, that has the ability to pay out if there's an accident.
Excellent.
One question I have on the insurance side, what's the difference between like working with a broker? Like we've had National Real Estate Insurance Group on, they seem to have a really good reputation, versus maybe like an individual guy that also does your homeowner's policy. I guess Tate asks, you know, what you'd look for, but maybe like, how does that work? And then, you know, maybe what are red flags? Like what would you not do, or what would you be kind of looking out for?
Well, so remember, a broker has the ability to shop a whole bunch of companies, right? And normally they're trying to find you the quote unquote best rates. So if price is the most important thing for you, then a broker is a great option, because they can find you some very cheap stuff. But if you're looking for more of an individual, to someone to sit down with you and actually go through things that I can see in person, I can go to their office, I can sit down, we can talk about what I have, go through these coverages, then you're looking for, you know, a local farmer's agent, or, you know, State Farm, or one of those local agents, which give you that more of the personal touch. But one thing with every insurance company, everyone needs to pay attention to, is that the premiums increase. And I had a good friend that got a license for Allstate, and he said, Adam, let me give you a quote on the insurance. And I gave him a quote, and he's like, well, that's better than I can do right now. And I said, okay. He said, well, but they're going to raise your rates, though. And I said, well, my rates haven't been raised. It's been quite some time, and I always pay attention to that. And he's like, well, they're going to raise it. I was made aware when I got my training that, you know, Allstate will give you a price, but every insurance company raises rates, so expect it. I said, yeah. Okay, well, I guess when they raise my rates, maybe we'll talk again. But until then, I think I'm in pretty good shape.
Well, I've got a question about the whole like being hidden, hiding your assets, hiding who you are, not being searchable online. What are some best practices on kind of disappearing online, you know, not being searchable? And how does that relate? So like, for example, one thing that I took away recently actually was, for whatever reason, on my LLCs, I was listed as not the registered agent, but I was listed on them. It pointed back to me as the manager, I believe, versus my operating company. Can you kind of speak to sort of how, you know, the searchability of who you are and how it kind of ties into how it could trip up you being named as liable in a lawsuit?
Yeah. So the attorneys will sue everything that they can find associated with a company, period, paragraph. So we just had a few months ago, I was doing a training with one of our attorneys on our real estate privacy trust. We use these special like land trust on steroids that we use for liability purpose to separate liability of properties. And your name's not on record. It's, we select a friend or family member, someone with a different last name, or our attorney serves as a trustee on the real estate privacy trust. So on public record will be the property's name, or, you know, 123 Main Street Trust, and then our attorney is the trustee. That's what goes on public record. Well, our attorney got named in a lawsuit because he was listed as the trustee. So some client in California got sued, and our attorney gets named because his name was on record associated with the property as the trustee. And then he has to go back and, you know, file a motion with the court and say, hey, you can't sue me. I'm just a trustee. I have no control, no ownership, no liability. I'm just a trustee. And he removes his name. But they sue everybody they possibly can. And in the privacy element of it, when we form the company, there is ways to do it where your name is not on record for the LLC. But at the end of the day, we can go into the hall of records. We can start getting in deep and pulling documents, and we can figure who you are. So just like with your personal residence, a lot of my clients don't want to put their primary residence on public record associated with their LLC. But I could go to if you're a voter, I can go to the voter rolls and get your personal address. So all these little hoops that you're trying to jump through to try and, you know, keep your name off public record, at the end of the day, good luck. It's just darn near impossible. Your name's going to go on something somewhere. It could be an insurance policy. It could be a mortgage. It could be anything that ends up getting scanned and put into a database, gets breached, and here you are.
I almost find this liberating because the jumping through hoops to try to stay anonymous has always proven exhausting for me. You know, it's like you start an LLC, but it, you know, the original Wyoming holding company that I used for my properties, we talked about that. The structure that always gets circulated is Wyoming holding company, and then you have properties in various states. And so you have an LLC in each one of those states that owns that property within the state, right? So when I started the Wyoming holding company, the attorney that drafted the operating agreement and filed the paperwork used my residence address on that holding company. So all someone had to do was Google the address and my name came up because I owned the property. So it was like, this is exhausting, right? So it's almost liberating to just say, hey, you're not going to hide, you know, just structure your entities properly so that even if you are found, which
you will
you're
be.
Going to, you will be, they can't access anything, right? I love this.
Put your phone number in Google and see what happens. And you're going to be like, yeah. Oh my God. And here's the reality, guys. My father-in-law was a very private person. He used a pager when he was a doctor, right? To like hide his identity. So no one could have his phone number. And for the longest time, you know, he was very private pager. He'd call you back on an unknown number and all this stuff, right? And I'll never forget the disgust he had when I got, I had actually access to not LexisNexis, but it's a thing called TLO, where I was looking up homeowners to go after them to try to buy property, right? And I put his name in, and we were joking around over beers, you know, where they put his name in there and it pulled up his personal home phone number. And he was pissed. And this is a guy that had literally tried to stay completely private for his entire life. And like, I had his phone number in 30 seconds. The reality is,
how many years ago?
How many years ago was that? Oh God, yeah. That was 10 years ago.
I mean, imagine how that has progressed today. I mean,
yeah, and so like,
yeah, good luck.
Good luck. And guess what? these attorneys, law firms, they have LexisNexis, they have TLOxp, they have all these tools. They put your name in there and boom, they've got your social, they know where you live, they know your VIN number. They even have the pilot registry. They can pull your licenses. Right. They can see how you've registered as a Republican or a Democrat or whatever. They can see everything. So to think that you're hidden.
So it's almost liberating to just say, listen, you're not going to stay anonymous. So with that, we can just move forward and relax. So Adam, I want to talk about the, you know, I mentioned the classic system of LLC in the state that owns the property and then the Wyoming holding company. We discussed on episode 119, the alternative structure that you use. I'd love for you to recap that. And then I really want to get into the partnership and S Corp duo that that you propose. So I love that. And then we can get into some nitty gritty on the partnerships and S Corps. I really want to get there because we didn't get there on 119.
So if you are buying, if you have a residential property, so residential being fourplex, triplex, duplex, single family home, townhome, condo, instead of putting a separate LLC for every property, we are going to put the property into the real estate privacy trust. It's like a land trust on steroids. It separates the liability without having to have a bunch of LLCs. And for most of you, if you have a property now, you always get the best rates. You buy it using your name and your credit. That gives you the best rates. And then you quick claim it into an LLC and you're protected, but you violate the mortgage agreement. And as soon as the bank sells the mortgage or does their internal audit and find that you're not on record, they can always call the mortgage due. Well, by putting the property into a trust, there's a federal law called the Garn-St. Germain Act of 1982. We put the property into a trust. By law, the bank can do nothing. Mortgage stays in your name, still got to make your payments, but legally the property is now held by the trust. When we form that trust, there is a...
And might I add, you skip the conveyance tax, which I have personally dealt with many times, moving properties in and out of LLCs, paying the state conveyance tax every time I move it, which is not inconsequential. It's a lot of money. $2,000, $3,000 every time you move it in and out of an LLC. Completely eliminates that issue when you use a trust instead.
I agree. And there's, I will note, Oregon is the only state in the country that does not allow us to use these real estate privacy trusts. So if you have a property in Oregon, it is what it is. You got to use an LLC. And Pennsylvania, our firm, we will not do trust in Pennsylvania. I'll do a revocable trust, a family trust, no problem. But real estate privacy trust, we won't do because you're going to have to pay the damn transfer tax between 2 and 5% when you put property into a real estate privacy trust in Pennsylvania. Whereas in any other state, there is no transfer tax, like you just talked about. So I've got this trust, and the trust has a lifetime beneficiary and a death time beneficiary. So during the course of your life, the beneficiary of the trust or the owner of the trust is the Wyoming LLC. So accident happens, you get drug into court. Well, first question, do you own this property? And your answer, well, no, Your Honor, I don't. Who does? The 123 Main Street Trust. Their very next question, are you the beneficiary of the 123 Main Street Trust? Well, no, Your Honor, I'm not. Who is? The Wyoming LLC. And they get nothing. Can't pierce the veil. You're not committing fraud. Can't foreclose on cash or assets. We have the charging order protection. They get stuck with a judgment hoping you someday distribute a profit. They are only entitled to profit distributions. And the lawyers all know the game. That LLC will never be profitable again, and they will never get a dime. So that's puts us in a good spot. So that's the trust. We got the trust, which is owned by the LLC. And then the LLC, you're the manager. And so very, very important. You personally would never hire a property manager. You would never enter into a lease agreement yourself. It is your LLC doing those things. So anytime contracts or agreements ask for initials, just put your initials. If it asks for a signature, always, always sign your name, comma, manager, or your name as manager of ABC Properties LLC. And it's very important because in the event of a lawsuit, they're looking for any holes that they can. If they can come back and say, hey, you see this lease agreement here, and I see that you signed it, but you didn't sign as manager. And And had we known we were dealing with a corporate entity, this might have been different. So they leave all these holes to try and get you one way or the other. So the simplicity is that you use your entity to do business. You sign contracts and agreements as manager. And do not ever use your personal checking account to pay for personal for business bills. Don't use the business account to pay personal bills. Keep it separate.
And the key differentiator here is that, and this is what I love about the simplicity of the system, is instead of having, let's say you own 20 rental properties, and we're talking residential here, because if it's a commercial property, if it's 5 units or more, it's going to be an LLC. That's a different ballgame. But if you own a single family, duplex, triplex, quad, those are residential properties, they're going to be in trusts. And then it's only one LLC rather than 20. So you've got this Wyoming LLC that serves as the beneficiary on all of these trusts. And when you change the beneficiary, it's not on public record. That is a private transaction in the trust documents, correct?
That is correct. So it's a great way to separate liability without having to have a bunch of LLCs. And that's the beauty. I've got one LLC with one checking account that will collect rent, pay expenses, whatever's left, bank transfer yourself the money for accounting purpose. That's a distribution, and tax time rolls around. If it's just you or you and your spouse, that LLC can be disregarded, meaning it will not even file a separate return. Everything just reports on your personal 1040 Schedule E, or you could file it as a partnership with you and your spouse.
What I want to get into next. But before we do, I do want to call out that if you've got, you know, 5 properties, let's say, you don't have to funnel all that those funds into the same bank account. That one LLC, that one Wyoming LLC that is the beneficiary on all of these trusts can have a separate bank account. You can have, an entity can have 5 bank accounts, right? So, and you just name each checking account the associated property account. It's genius. So let's attack this, because this, I think, is another key idea, a key concept on this is making that entity a partnership rather than a disregarded entity. Because we all know that when you own rental property, all of it flows onto your Schedule E. And I mean, that creates some audit risk, right? So let's talk about creating a partnership instead, so that it kicks off a K-1. And now this cleans up your tax return. Everything rolls up to that partnership return, and you just get a nice simple K-1 for all of your rental properties.
Yeah, it's a great way to do it. And if you're single and you don't have a spouse, then you could set up a LLC taxed as an S corporation to serve as a management company that owns 1% of your LLC that holds your property. So now I file a partnership between me and my S corp. So that's always an option if you're a single person. But by doing it this way, you mentioned on your personal return, you've got 1040 Schedule E, and when you got multiple rentals, it is a fat, sloppy tax return. Bankers hate you.
Real quick, a Schedule E is just part of the tax return where you're going to put all your revenue and expenses for your rental property. That's all that means. So when you say Schedule E, it's like you own one rental property, you're going to have a schedule in your tax return, in your 1040, right? That you have to say, I made this much money in my rental and I had these expenses and this is my profit. That's all that is, right? So now what we're saying is you're not doing that for a bunch of properties on your personal tax return. You're actually going up a level, creating an operating company that is going to have what's called a 1065, which is a tax return. This is another tax return that, and you're going to have to file
it's a partnership
that,
return.
Right. And so if you're thinking about doing this, like, all CPAs is now coming to your head, because now you're doing a partnership return where you're rolling in multiple properties and you've got books for it and things like that. And that partnership return then generates what's called a K-1, which is basically just saying what your profit and losses are for that. And that's going to give you depreciation and all these things. If you think about it, if you're in a syndication, the operator is doing your 1065. So I do like maybe 90 1065s every year. I don't know what it is, right? And then about 4,000 K-1s go out to the individual investors. And so you get this nice, you don't do a Schedule E with a syndication, you do a K-1. So you're basically just kind of, because the operator's doing your tax returns, lots of people in the partnership, things like that.
So you're essentially doing the same thing with your own personal rental properties. Is you're creating this operating company where the properties are essentially the business, the profits and losses flow through the partnership, and the partnership, the way that partnerships are taxed is that the partnership doesn't pay tax. All of the profits and loss flow through to the individual owners, and so it kicks off a K-1 to you.
Yeah, and that's the K-1, right? If you hear the word K-1, that means you're in something with lots of people, or you're in a partnership, effectively, right?
More than one. Or
multiple ads, yeah. Sorry, so what's the benefit of this? So as an individual, let's get back to the,
So twofold. Number one, keeps your personal return nice and clean. Just some W-2s and K-1s on your personal return. And then the anytime you're filing, I really had a big audit risk with people filing a Schedule E, unless you're trying to cram a bunch of expenses, like you got a ton of mileage that you're cramming into your Schedule E, or you're trying to do a home office on a Schedule E. All of those things are not good because the IRS looks at percentages of profits going to this, that, the other. If it's outside the norm, it throws up a red flag. So by doing this partnership, it reduces your audit risk. The number one audit risk is a Schedule C. You know, if you have a business, that's a Schedule C. That's an active income type of thing. I haven't seen a bunch of issues with Schedule E unless you're trying to cram stuff in there, but it cleans up the personal return. And when you go to get mortgages, anything that goes on your Schedule E, and there's two parts. There's part one and part two of Schedule E. Part one is where you itemize out all your properties. Part two is where we put the K-1s. So if anybody is getting a mortgage on a property and they're looking at your debt-to-income ratio, everything on part one, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac guidelines are, they can give you a 75% credit of the rent you're getting towards your debt-to-income ratio. However, I've got a good friend that has a mortgage company, and he said, if we do a partnership, I can give you 100% towards your debt-to-income if it shows up on part two. So that's that can be helpful as well. I was just talking to a doctor. He owns an oncology center, and he's got a bunch of properties, commercial, residential. And I was working with his CPA, and I said, I would like to go ahead and file that as a partnership this year. We got our LLC in place, but let's do it as a partnership. And I was actually also talking with his banker because he's, buying properties all the time. And I asked his banker, Erica, I said, Erica, I'm going to put this under a partnership from now on. And her response was, thank God. He said, we cringe every time he comes in because he's got all these properties and we got to enter all this crap in here. And it's a real pain in our butt. So
yeah,
it cleans it up, and the bankers love you when you just have a clean personal return with W-2s and K-1s.
I love it.
Yeah. And this might be like really over detailed, but like we have a DST. So if you have a 1031 exchange and you want to invest your 1031 exchange profits into one of our self-storage deals, we have that. In that case, it's not a partnership. So you do get the revenue and income that goes into your Schedule E. So there are certain types of syndications that, I mean, that's not a syndication per se, but it's a passive investment that would not generate a K-1. And likewise, if you did a tick into a 1031, you're likely going to get some kind of a financial record that's going to have your itemized list of things for the purposes of doing a Schedule E as well. And by the way, you really hit the nail on the head when you simplify your tax return. Even though I'm involved in a million different things and Tate the same way, but me personally, I have no Schedule E's on my tax return, believe it or not. I'm literally a W-2 and a K-1. So it's very clean, and it makes your personal side actually pretty neat and tidy, because I don't have a bunch of rental properties anymore. So kind of nice.
Speaking of partnerships, 1065s. So let's talk about syndication deals. And I'm a little scared because I think that the number of investors that are going to reach out after we broach this subject and ask to transfer their interest is going to be pretty wild, but let's do it. What is the correct way to hold your limited partnership interests?
So it is based on your risk tolerance level. You can either have those syndications being held in your revocable living trust, or a better way to do it is to set up a Wyoming LLC as a holding company that holds your syndication interest. This will be a disregarded LLC. It will not file a separate return. But by doing it this way, if God forbid you got sued personally, a car wreck or something, whatever syndications you have are under this Wyoming LLC, they can sue you. They can win. They cannot touch that Wyoming LLC to satisfy your personal debts and obligations. So it protects those syndication investments from your own personal liability. And this is only a few states have this. In Nevada and Wyoming, these have the reverse piercing protection, where if you set your company up in Arizona or California or other states, you don't get that protection. If they sued you, they're able to take your California LLC that has your syndication investments. So definitely Wyoming.
So, and I want to be clear that it's fine. You know, if you want to hold a syndication in your personal name, there's no inside attack danger, right? If somebody slips and falls in Ryan's storage unit, you can't be held personally liable. You are a limited partner. So the most you can ever lose in that syndication deal is the amount of money that you put into it. You are not on the hook. You are not liable for something that happens in that. So that's why we say you don't really have any risk by holding one of these limited partner positions in your personal name. But if you get sued personally and it's in your personal name, it's now accessible to the creditor. And that's why we're saying separate Wyoming LLC, off to the side, not associated with anything, and it's just a DRE, a disregarded entity, that flows through onto your personal return. So the K-1 is not under Ryan Gibson, it's under XYZ Holdings in Wyoming, which Ryan Gibson then owns, and it flows through to Ryan's tax returns. Now, why Wyoming? One, yeah, because it's such good laws, but I also will mention it's the cheapest, because what does Nevada cost? 400 something a year? Wyoming, $62, $64.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I do want to point out the LLC that would hold your syndications would also be the same LLC that I would use if you have a brokerage account, a personal brokerage account. Now, IRAs and 401ks, those are protected under federal bankruptcy law. However, if you have a personal brokerage account, I can put your syndications, your brokerage account, those can go into this Safe Asset Holdings LLC. It does not hold any risk-producing assets. It is just holding your investments.
Excellent. Yeah, it's not driving around a car, right? It's not doing anything that is going to incite liability. It just sits off to the side doing nothing but holding those assets.
And if you're listening to this and you're a Spartan investor or you're a Turbine Capital investor and you want to change your titling in your syndications, that's no problem. We can handle that.
Yep.
So
absolutely.
Just send us an email. You know, once you talk to Adam about your setup and, you know, everything is good and you say, okay, I've got my trust set up, I got my LLC set up, whatever it is, we can transfer the investment from your personal name into your new entity structure. You will get two K-1s that year typically. It means you'll get a K-1 that concludes your prior investment and then begins the new one. And then we do the paperwork and get you all, you know, usually it results in some kind of termination agreement of the old and a subscription of the new. And it's not a big deal. So people always ask, like,
for us, it's a one page transfer form. You can go to your settings on your dashboard, add an account, create the entity account, name, yeah, EIN, address, and then reach out to us. We can do the transfer of interest.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a day at most. So please, I mean, I know Tate kind of joked around about, you know, this is going to cause an onslaught of transfers,
a tidal wave of transfers.
You know what? We want you to be in the best protection as possible, right? First and foremost. So that's why, like, we've literally set up our respective teams to handle this, because we know this is a thing, right? You do the first deal, it's in your name. You do the second deal, the third deal, the fourth deal. And then you kind of realize, like, hey, I need to make sure that I've got my stuff protected and it's in the right place. So I want to go through this process. So
Adam, you talked about putting your brokerage account into that LLC. How do you do that?
Yeah. So LLC gets formed, you get your paperwork in the mail. It usually takes us about a week to get you all of your documents, your initial organizational minutes, an operating agreement, and the paperwork that you need. And we'll have the the new EIN number for your company, and you literally call your brokerage firm, you'll call Fidelity or Charles Schwab or whoever you've got your account with and say, hey guys, I set up an LLC. I just want to transfer my account into the LLC. You'll give them a new W-9, sign a new form, and boom, they transfer the stuff into your new account. Pretty darn simple.
Excellent. So no trust involved or anything like that?
Yes, yeah. Correct.
Well, amazing. If we didn't put everybody to sleep, we wanted to...
I'm fired up. I love this stuff.
No, I know. It's important. It's super important. But we did get technical. But, you know, Adam, how do people get in touch with you? You know, first of all, thank you for coming on. I mean, I know people are going to have more questions about this. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Yep. Send me an email, adam@nchinc.com. So again, adam@nchinc.com. It stands for Nevada Corporate Headquarters. We went woke and we were Nevada Corporate Headquarters, and now we went woke. We got initials, NCH. So
nice. I like it. Yeah, you're going to get, the last time you had you on the show, I think you got absolutely blown up by our listeners. So I hope you have somebody helping you out with your emails here after the show airs. So,
And I will tell you this, the thing about working with our firm is I don't just set this up and never talk to you. We set it up and we continue to work with you over time. So we have CPAs, we have our attorneys, we help people build business credit. We do self-directed IRAs and self-directed 401ks. We do the estate planning, the trust and wills. So it's all the support services for business owners and investors is what our firm specializes in. And I am not an investment advisor, so I never tell people what to buy, when to buy, or where to buy. But like with a self-directed account or things of that nature, I'm an expert in prohibited transactions and how to not screw it up. So that's where I come in.
Nice.
Well, Adam, you're an amazing coach on this. Lots of wisdom. Thank you so much for joining us again. We are going to leave the door open for the next episode talking about S-Corps and management companies. So, you know, we've talked about getting that partnership 1065 set up to serve as the beneficiary of your real estate privacy trust. So essentially your holding company that holds all your real estate. We're going to talk about management companies on the next episode, S-Corps, and how to maybe shift some of your expenses over into that management company that actually takes a more active role. So thank you so much for joining us today. Look forward to the next episode. We'll talk to you soon.
Awesome.